From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Celeste Headlee. It's Here and Now. The CDC's reversal on mask wearing will impact Americans differently depending on where they live. The CDC now says people in communities with high levels of COVID-19 transmissions should mask up in public places indoors, even if they're fully vaccinated. It also recommends universal mask wearing for kids, teachers, and staff in schools. This all comes as vaccination rates have stalled and cases of the Delta variant are on the rise. Let's bring in Dr. Abdul El-Sayed, who's an epidemiologist and former city health commissioner for Detroit, Michigan. Dr. El-Sayed, welcome back.
Celeste, thank you so much for having me.
What is your take on this new mask guidance from the CDC? How should we read this?
Well, on the one hand, it's rather clear that the CDC is following new science. We know that this Delta variant that we're dealing with right now is fundamentally more transmissible than the garden variety COVID that we dealt with last year, for example, and even the Alpha variant that came after that. Now, the question that the CDC wanted to ask was, how much more likely is it for vaccinated people to transmit Delta than they were to transmit other variants? And what they'd found before was that vaccinated people, owing to low levels of virus in their nasopharynx, that place behind your nose and your face where the virus tends to hang out, was so low that they were not at high risk of transmitting. What they found with Delta, though, is that in their transmission chains, in their outbreak investigations, they found that vaccinated people, in fact, were carrying substantially more virus and therefore were transmitting this virus. And so to protect both vaccinated people and unvaccinated people, they made a recommendation in high transmission areas for these folks to wear them. But on the other hand, the big question that the CDC, I think, has not reckoned with is the impact of their recommendations. The reality of it is that the reason high transmission places are high transmission is because people are not paying attention to what the CDC says about either vaccines or masks. And so making this recommendation, one has to ask whether or not it's going to be effective in the first place.
And there has been some criticism about this new guidance from the CDC. Dr. Scott Gottlieb is a former FDA commissioner, current board member for Pfizer, and spoke about the new CDC guidance on NPR's Morning Edition.
I think in terms of telling everyone who's been vaccinated that they need to now start wearing a mask again, I think that's going to be very little bang for our buck in terms of trying to reduce transmission right now in the context of this wave of infection.
So, Dr. El-Sayed, would you agree with Dr. Gottlieb there that asking vaccinated people to mask up won't have a big impact?
You know, I think what's going to happen is you're going to see a lot of folks who are vaccinated in low transmission areas masking up out of caution. And then folks in high transmission areas where people have not been paying attention to CDC guidelines for some time now, that mask wearing is likely not going to go up substantially. And so I agree with Scott's perspective there. The bigger point here, though, is that we have to be focusing on vaccines. These are the number one tool that we have to reduce COVID-19 transmission. And in order to do that, what we fundamentally have to do is make being vaccinated easier and make being unvaccinated harder. And so I'm quite focused on the next step that the Biden administration may be taking in the near future here around mandating vaccines for federal employees. I think that's going to have a lot more effect, not just for those federal employees, but because it creates a permission structure for employees, employers around the country to be doing the same thing.
What about the recommendation for schools in which they're saying everyone going to a public school should be masked? In light of the fact that kids under 12 can't currently get a vaccine, do you think this guidance is on target?
I do. And I think this owes to the fact that we're seeing more cases among young people that are really symptomatic and very serious, in fact, because of Delta. And given the fact that we still don't have vaccines that are authorized for people under the age of 12, I think it does make sense to do everything we can to protect our young people in the places where we put them most of the day, most of the year, which is in their schools. And so I do think that this is in keeping with what we're coming to understand about Delta and in keeping with the responsibility we have to protect people who, through no fault of their own, cannot be vaccinated simply because of their age right now.
It's hard to imagine we'd be a little bit nostalgic for what you called garden variety COVID. The Delta variant seems a lot worse. And I wonder if you think it's possible that those who are fully vaccinated will end up having to get another shot or two more shots.
Well, it is certainly within the realm of possibility, but here's the situation that I hope folks are paying attention to. This virus can change. This virus can do what it needs to do to evade our immune system's response to it. And what we've seen with Delta is that for people who've had COVID before and are therefore developing a natural immunity because of that, that immunity is not as effective against limited. Preventing Delta. Yeah. And so we have responsibility to protect folks in this respect, and we have to be paying attention to that future.
We'll leave it there. That's Dr. Abdul Al-Sayed, epidemiologist, former city health commissioner for Detroit. Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, to Tokyo now, where American swimmer Katie Ledecky won her first gold at these Olympics, and the U.S. men's basketball team rebounded, beating Iran. And Simone Biles, the greatest gymnast, one of the greatest athletes of all time, decided to not compete in the all-around individual competition after withdrawing from the team finals yesterday for her own mental health. She remains the headline. NPR's Russell Lewis is in Tokyo. Hi, Russell.
Hey there.
And Simone Biles withdrew from the team competition, as we know, and today announced she's not competing in the all-round individual. That's when an individual does everything from floor to vault. As she very strongly put it in the press conference yesterday, the mental isn't there. So what's the sense? Might she compete next week?
It's anyone's guess at this point. Basically, what USA Gymnastics is saying is they're taking it day by day. They're checking in on her day by day. And so it's really anyone's guess. But the fact that she is not competing tomorrow in the all-around is a sign that perhaps things are not well. It is her signature event. It is something that she won in Rio de Janeiro 5 years ago, and it is something where she just excels at. So the fact that she is willing to sit this one out still says that she's still working on things.
As you may know, there in Tokyo, there are trolls here in the U.S. criticizing her on social media, but Olympic giant Michael Phelps said the news about Simone Biles broke his heart. He's very open about his own struggles with anxiety. And we're reminded that Simone Biles was one of the gymnasts sexually abused by team doctor Larry Nassar. She said as a result, she slept all the time because it was better than offing herself. So now some sports writers are saying that she's opened a new chapter. There's something new going on because of her strong stand on her own mental health. What are you seeing there in Tokyo?
Well, what you're seeing is almost unanimous support for her from her fellow athletes, from the USA gymnastics team to other athletes competing for the U.S. in other sports, notably Katie Ledecky, coming out basically in support of her. And we're hearing from others that say it's good. I mean, I think we have to remember it is not easy to compete at the Olympics. This is the highest of high levels. And 70% of Olympians only compete in one Olympics. So you look at someone like Simone Biles, who's competing in two, you're carrying that on your shoulders, especially someone who is as good as she is. She is the greatest of all time, the best gymnast that we've ever seen. And to be carrying that not for a four-year cycle of the Olympics, but due to the coronavirus pandemic, a fifth year. And so she's had the weight of that on her shoulders, and it's not easy. And I think we forget how difficult it is just to perform all of these moves and knowing full well that you're on the floor for a minute. A vault literally takes 5 seconds, and you've been training for years and years. It is just this little moment of time, and it is just a tremendous amount of pressure. Some people manage to deal with it just fine, but others, it is hard and it's challenging, and I don't think it's really fair for anyone to judge how it is that she's handling it. Let's remember, she is the greatest of all time. She is an incredible Olympic champion, and you know, if she's going through these difficult, tough times, then that's for her to go through and to deal with.
Well, Russell, well put, and to see her, as she said, lose her way in the middle of that five-second vault in which she could have broken her neck, you feel it's her call. But you mentioned Katie Ledecky, who won a gold in the women's 1500 meter. This is an event that's just available to women this year, this grueling 1500 meter swim. Tell us about that race.
Yeah, it's 1500 meters making its debut at these Olympics. I mean, 1500 meters in swimming terms, it's a marathon. It's just under a mile. It's 4,921 feet. And she completed it today in just a little over 15 minutes. And in true Katie Ledecky fashion, she won by 4 seconds over American Erica Sullivan. And so, I mean, when it comes to her, she's used to touching the wall and then turning around and watching her competitors touch the wall after her many, many seconds later. It is really her strength. She is a distance specialist, and you know, this is where she excels. She's had a tough Olympics up to this point. She's sort of found new competition in Australia's Ariane Titmus, who has beaten her now twice. And so it has been a challenge for her, but she has won the gold, and she has one more individual event coming up. It is the 800-meter freestyle. It's an event that she won in Rio and set a world record in Rio de Janeiro 5 years ago. But she will also be competing with her Australian nemesis, and so it should actually be a pretty great race for her, and we'll see how she does.
NPR's Russell Lewis in Tokyo. Russell, thank you so much.
Yes, you're welcome.
Years ago, poet Ruth Forman was shocked when her daughter came home from pre-K and said she wished her hair were straighter and her skin was lighter. And when Ruth Forman turned to children's books to find some positive messages for very young Black readers, just like her daughter, she realized there were not a lot of options, so she decided to write one of her own. Curls has illustrations by Geneva Bowers and came out last December. This May, the pair published Glow for Black Boys. And Ruth Forman joins us now to talk about both books. Ruth, welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you.
I know, as a parent myself, I know it's a shock when you try to create an environment for your children, try to give them positive messages and help them have self-esteem. It's always a shock when they come home from school saying things and your first reaction might be, who said that to you? Who told you that? And I wonder what went through your mind when she came home and said that.
Yeah, that's such a great question. Because beforehand, I mean, we had surrounded her with all of these wonderful experiences and images. And she was doing African dance at the time. And I remember it was in the bathroom when she said this to me. I was hurt. I could have gotten very upset. I could have cried, I could have yelled, but my first step somewhere along the way in my training was to take a breath. And I took a breath, and then I figured, okay, what can I tell her? And so I very carefully, you know, told her and explained to her about the people that she did feel were beautiful, that were brown, and who had wonderful curly hair that she did already, you know, love and felt very connected to. Afterward, I really thought about it. Okay, what can I do? What can I do to help her right now? I just didn't realize it would happen so soon. I didn't realize it could happen around 3 or 4. And then as a writer, I just thought, you know what? Let me just start writing. I was already writing something else, but I said, let me go younger. They need this. And I was talking with other parents and they were having the same experience.
It would seem to me that being a poet is probably helpful when you're writing for children. How does understanding rhyme and meter and cadence influence the way you write for kids?
I think being a poet is helpful, but being a mom is best. When I was thinking about what would work for kids, there were so many things I was thinking about as a mother. My daughter was learning to read around the time that I got the inspiration for Curls. And I realized that the words had to be very simple, words that they could learn to read and be proud of reading. I realized the book had to be short. You know, they are always asking for books before they go to bed, and you want to read something that's not too long. And then the poet kicked in terms of what would work in terms of rhyme, in terms of meter, in terms of pace, in terms of what words would feel wonderful to say in the mouth.
So I wonder if we could read Curls together. With each of us taking a page. I mean, the book is tactily, it's, you know, it's a board book, very, very thick pages, and it's tactily pleasant to hold in your hands. And the illustrations are just so lovely. And I wondered if we could read through it.
I would love to.
Okay, if you will start us off, I will read every other page.
Sounds good. Me mourning.
Mirror, smile.
Shine big hair, love.
Up, soft black brown.
Thick curl, sun crown.
Smooth grease, yes please.
Sweet braids.
Beads sway.
Sit, no, never, ever.
Always free.
Like me.
And there's this great picture on that last page with four different natural hairstyles that I just love. Did you read this to her?
I think, you know, as we were going through the different phases of the process, I did share the words and I did share the images. But at the same time, like, I was also writing a lot of things for her. So I shared a lot of things with her at that time. So I think this was one of them as well.
So you were working on this years ago, and I wonder how you feel now seeing the headlines. We're still having controversy over black and brown women's hair. Even at the Olympics, where black women were wearing what's called a soul cap, it's designed to accommodate all of the hair that a black swimmer might have, it was banned by the International Swimming Federation. How do you feel when you see this still being controversial?
I think it's one step at a time. I feel like I'm trying to do my part in people like my daughter understanding that this hair is normal hair as well. But I also feel like other children who will read this book will feel that way. And when we start to see difference as normal, that's when some of the changes will begin to come. But when curly hair is still seen as different or even aberrant, these things are going to come up. So I just want to try to equip my daughter and the children in this generation as much as possible with that sense of self-love, self-worth, knowing who they are, so that when these things do come, it will not harm them in the way that I think it's harmed many generations before.
I wonder about the process of publishing for you, because, you know, we have been talking for a very long time about the lack of diversity in publishing, not just for children's books, but for all books. Is it getting better, do you think, in recent years?
Yeah, I definitely think it's getting better. Fortunately for children who are, you know, very young readers, they have a lot more to have in their library than my daughter did. And I hope it continues. I hope it flourishes. But it's not that we haven't been writing these books. I think it's just that the books have not necessarily been picked up.
Your daughter is 6 or 7 years older now than when she first made that comment.
Mm-hmm.
Any change in her thoughts?
Oh, my goodness, yes. I mean, honestly, we just had a call out to friends and family, you know, please send us books for children of color, send us books that are celebrating hair, celebrating skin. And I would say within 2 months, that conversation was done. And that's when I realized how important, I knew literature was important before, but I really realized how important literature was when we read her those books. And within 2 months, that was it.
Wow. Have you heard from parents of boys as well about GLOW?
Yes, it's beautiful. I love the stories. I get a lot of stories of the boy saying, that's me, that's me, that's my friend, that's me. I hear that they ask for the book every night. The book is called GLOW, or the book is called Bath when they're asking for it.
Because the little boy takes a little bath before bedtime. Yeah.
But the stories are very sweet. But a lot of them are just the idea. And this is for both the girls with the Curls book and the boys with the GLOW book, where lots of children see themselves. So that makes me feel so grateful, because the healing then is not just for my family, or not even healing, but it's almost like a want to say a protection, and protection may not even be the right word, but for so many other children, when they are able to see themselves on that cover or in that book and feel very proud of how they look and not start to question who they are at such a young age.
I think of it more like as a guiding light leading them this way instead of that way.
Mm.
And I wonder, yeah. Last question for you, but is it more important for a black or brown child to read this or a white child?
I wouldn't say it's more important for either. I think it's important for them in different ways. I think one of the comments that I remember reading on Instagram from a mom quoting her daughter said, "They look so happy," like it was a surprise.
Wow.
We have so many moments of celebration in our community and in our traditions and in our lives, but I think sometimes people don't get to see that. So for a child, a white child, to see smiling, happy brown children as normal, I think that's important. For black and brown children to feel, you know, proud of who they are and what they've got. But also for all children to see this aspect of our experience. And I think Black joy is so, it's so much a part of how we survive. It's so much a part of how we are able to continue amidst everything that we have gone through. And also, there's one aspect in GLOW I wanted to highlight as well, which is that the boy is loved by the natural environment. He is loved and comforted by that moon. And I think that's very much a part of our experience as well. I wanted brown boys reading that book to feel a sense of safety and love and belonging, not just from family, but also from the natural world. As a child, I remember experiences that made me feel loved and protected by the natural world. I wanted to put that in the book as well.
Ruth Forman is the author of Curls and GLOW, books for pre-K and kindergarten readers with illustrations by Geneva Bowers. Ruth, it's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you.
To see some of Geneva Bowers' beautiful illustrations for Curls, go to hereandnow.org.
NPR's Planet Money Summer School is back. This season is all about investing. We've got stories of big bets, bubble spotting, and cute animals, too. Every Wednesday till Labor Day from NPR's Planet Money.
It's here and now. As Americans begin to return to the office, many are not returning to the trains and buses that got them there. According to ridership data, mass transit is having a slow and uneven recovery in some big cities. Here now, transportation analyst Seth Kaplan is here. And Seth, give us a sense of the numbers here. I mean, we're hearing anecdotally about empty trains in D.C. and empty buses in Chicago, but give us the numbers.
Yeah, well, sort of like a lot of things very broadly in life, Robin, up from where it was a year ago, but down from where it was before the pandemic, and more specifically with public transportation, we're talking ridership nationally of roughly half of what it once was. Now, at the depths of the pandemic, there truly was almost nobody riding, and in some cases down nearly 90%, depending on the city, places like San Francisco, but still far from where it once was overall.
Yeah, and by the way, we should say you're in an airport and those have been packed. But when it comes to public transit, what cities are struggling? What cities are maybe having a rebound?
Well, taking that second part first, if you look at cities like Atlanta, Los Angeles, those are places where the public transportation systems have fared better than others, as opposed to, Robin, you mentioned D.C., New York, places like those. And it's not really a big surprise if you think about the kinds of places where jobs have mostly gone remote and where people are considered, there's a term in public transportation, transit optional. You know, people who maybe own a car but choose to use public transportation when it's more convenient, as opposed to what are called the transit dependent people, people who maybe don't have a car, maybe are essential workers and just have to go to work no matter what. And those are the kinds of places, including Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, where I'm standing right now, we're riding ridership has rebounded. Both the larger cities that aren't as transit-oriented to begin with, like Los Angeles, and then those smaller cities with more of that transit-dependent population.
I'm so glad you said what you just said, because, you know, there are some people have the luxury of not choosing public transportation. I'm not saying it may be a hard choice for some, but I can hear some saying, well, I don't have a choice. I have to go clean a house or clean a building, and that's the only way that I have to get there. So it isn't always a choice. But what does it mean? You know, the last year left many city transit systems in financial trouble. What does it mean if ridership stays low?
Right, it did. And they've gotten some help here from the federal government, but at some point that's going to taper off. So they sort of were able to kick the old can down the road in terms of making really tough choices, long-term choices about cutting their systems. But absolutely, these are what you call fixed cost systems, Robin. That means a business where it just costs about the same amount to run the thing, no matter how many people are showing up and paying, right? The bus kind of costs the same amount to run, even if not very many people are getting on board and paying those fares. Generally, these are subsidized services. And so if for the long term, a lot of people who can make their choices and work remotely don't do that, that puts pressure on the systems that could end up hurting the people who need those systems no matter what.
Okay, just got half a minute here. We want to give the good news. Amtrak has announced it will be reinventing traditional dining car meals. You can go eat with people in a dining car.
You can. Now, these are on just some of the longer haul routes, the ones that go from east to west. But a little bit of a surprise, Robin. Amtrak had been cutting that kind of service and now bouncing back a little. They're cooking steaks to order, using fresh vegetables. So in some ways, even though overall more limited, nicer than it was in the old days when they just had more of the service to begin with.
Yeah. Here now, transportation analyst Seth Kaplan. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Robin.
This is the second time Tokyo has hosted the Summer Olympics. The first was in 1964.
The Games marked a special milestone for the Japanese people, as Tokyo had been selected as the host for the 1940 Games, but due to World War II, they had to be cancelled. To remark the country's recovery, a special torch bearer was chosen to light the cauldron. Sakai Yoshinori was a Japanese athlete born in Hiroshima on August 6, 1945, the same day the atomic bomb fell.
After that emotional opening ceremony, Japanese women's volleyball team won gold in the final against the Soviet Union, and that was just one of the game's highlights. Roy Tomizawa is the author of 1964, The Greatest Year in the History of Japan, How the Tokyo Olympics Symbolized Japan's Miraculous Rise from the Ashes, and he joins us from Tokyo. Thanks so much for being with us.
Great to be with you, Celeste.
I was interested to hear that there was no book on the 1964 Olympics. I mean, there are books about every single Olympics since they started holding them, and that when you went to go find a book to read about them, you couldn't. Any thoughts as to why?
I was quite lucky, but I suppose part of it is that anything dealing in the Japanese language is going to be a challenge for researchers and, you know, having to conduct all the interviews in Japanese, for example. But you know what? They could have translated probably books written in Japanese into English. I guess perhaps the interest in sports books is not as great as I would like. But on the other hand, I was quite fortunate that that was material not covered. So I could go with eyes wide open.
So I want to go back to that moment in history and give people some historical context. The Beatles played the Ed Sullivan Show in February of 64. The World's Fair was in New York that year. The U.S. was at war in Vietnam. The Civil Rights Act was signed into law. Muhammad Ali was the heavyweight champion of the world. How big a deal, in light of all these other major things going on, how big a deal was the Olympics worldwide?
I think it was a huge thing. I mean, there was a lot of noise, and even things that you didn't mention. There was the Warren Commission came out on the Kennedy assassination, and there was a three-man Soviet spaceship that went around the world during the Olympic Games, and Khrushchev actually stepped down during the Games. There was an A-bomb that China went off, that China exploded during the Games. But, you know, people during the Olympics were focused on the sports, so the athletes certainly they didn't really notice the geopolitical movements going around the world. And perhaps it was a soft spot in the geopolitical rumblings. If the Tokyo had hosted the games in 68 or 72, they probably would not have been able to organize such a smoothly run games.
So we heard that clip about the opening ceremonies, and a man who was born on the very day that Hiroshima was bombed lit the Olympic cauldron. Your argument is that the 64 Olympics represented a rebirth for Japan, that this was sort of a mile marker of all that went before and all that came after. What do you mean?
It's really just hard to believe in terms of numbers, 19 years after the end of the war. And those who've read books on the history of Japan, and particularly the bombings of Tokyo, will remember pictures of cities in rubbles, particularly Tokyo. So if you look at those pictures and you say, okay, 19 years later, you're going to hold arguably the most logistically complex operations, peacetime operations that you could possibly do in the 20th century. 19 years later, I think most people would laugh at you. It's, you know, it would be the equivalent of Dresden trying to hold the games in 1964 as well. So the challenge was phenomenally great. I mean, Japan was devastated. In some ways, it was a pariah. So getting to the games and then running a fantastic one, according to all the visitors, that achievement was unprecedented. The first Asian Olympics, and the Japanese were praised the world over for their efficiency, modernity, and friendliness. And I think the most important thing was that the consensus in Japan, from government to corporation to student, all the way down the line, it was universal. Everyone wanted the Olympics to succeed. And that's why it was such a watershed moment in Japanese history.
And the bullet trains began to run as the games opened. I mean, it sounds like there is a lot of consensus and people working together, but logistically speaking, how did they pull it off?
I guess the biggest reason, there was this huge momentum from the economy, what we call the Japanese economic miracle. Japan had found its strengths in the export markets, and the Japanese were at a moment of great innovation and creativity. You know, necessity is the mother of invention, as they say. And so tremendous creativity and innovation in the 1950s and 1960s, particularly in the major manufacturing industries like automobiles and electronics, for example. So the whole country was humming, and everyone was working hard to get the country back on its feet. And so when the Olympics came around, it was actually a time to breathe and pat themselves on the back. I think they were all amazed at what they had accomplished at that point.
Now, you have a personal connection to the 64 Olympics in Tokyo. Your father worked as an editor for NBC during those games. What did he say about the Olympic Games of 64?
I wish I'd asked more. He passed away before I could ask him questions when I was writing the book. But, you know, of course, he had brought back all sorts of memorabilia from those games, coins and patches and things of that nature. And I do remember him talking about the Japanese women's volleyball team, about the training that they underwent so that they could be as good as they were. But we're a family of sports fans as well, so you know we just love sports. And NBC, when he was working for NBC and they had regained the contract to broadcast, I was hoping secretly one day that I can get on some sort of NBC team to help out, but that never happened.
In research for this book, you ended up interviewing some 70 athletes from 16 different countries, as I understand. What surprised you? What did you hear that came as a surprise?
I don't think there were surprises as such, but they had endless anecdotes and stories of those days. And to me, it was just such a revelation to hear about how they thought about Japan. I felt honored to be able to hear their stories and to play them back in the book. It was always my dream while I was writing the book that when we had Tokyo 2020, that they would come visit during the Olympics and we would grab tickets for their event in 64 and watch it together and just have a grand old time. And of course, that never came to be. So,
I mean, it's a little bit sad that the Tokyo is again having the Olympics after a worldwide tragedy, right? I mean, the Tokyo Olympics today are coming after a global pandemic. And I wonder what you think of the games that are happening right now. We know that fans aren't allowed in, so, you know, there's nobody cheering in the crowds, or not very many. And we're seeing protests outside of the arenas. How do you feel about the games right now? Was it too soon?
I don't think the Japanese government or the Japanese people would wish this situation on any other host city. Any decision to cancel, proceed, or postpone all have issues. I think, in a way, the only logical decisions have been made so far. I sort of wish personally that the organizers and the Japanese government agreed on having fans in the stands. There was just too much evidence that you could do it. You know, even in Japan, professional baseball had upwards of 10,000 people in the stands on game day. Last Saturday or two Saturdays ago, Team France and Team Japan had a basketball friendly in Okinawa, which was also under a state of emergency, and they had people in the stands. And of course, you know, in America, there's people in the stands in almost every professional event there is. So there was a professional wrestling match in Tokyo Dome, I think, a few days ago. So, you know, I think there's enough signs that we could have done it, but obviously the organizers felt that the public sentiment was so negative and that they had to respect that. And I respect that, too, even though I had a lot of tickets.
I bet you did. Roy Tomizawa is speaking with us from Tokyo. He is the author of 1964, The Greatest Year in the History of Japan, How the Tokyo Olympics Symbolized Japan's Miraculous Rise from the Ashes. Roy, thanks so much. And I guess enjoy the Olympics in your city from the TV screen.
I am, and I will. Thank you very much.
Nashville radio talk show host Phil Valentine remains hospitalized in critical condition, battling COVID-19, more than 2 weeks after being admitted. And after months of Valentine dismissing the vaccine, saying it was a personal choice, as he wrote, "What are my odds of getting COVID? They're pretty low. What are my odds of dying from COVID if I do get it? Probably way less than 1%. I'm doing what everyone should do, and that's my own personal health risk assessment." He even wrote a parody of the Beatles song Taxman. He called it Vaxman. He wrote, "If you don't like me coming round, be thankful I don't hold you down, because I'm the Vaxman. Yeah, I'm the Vaxman." Well, now Phil Valentine wants you to know he was wrong, but he's struggling to breathe. So his brother Mark is speaking for him. Mark, just how are you and your family doing? And Phil?
He is extremely sick, and part of the protocol, as I understand it, is a turning and positioning regimen that puts someone away from the supine or on their back position and onto their side, then onto their stomach to keep the fluid from collecting in his lungs. And that's a critical part of the treatment, and that's part of what they're doing. But he is very, very sick, and we're in for the long haul, it looks like, and it's a bad time, and he wishes he could do it over.
Well, he wishes he could do it over. Yeah. Look, can you take us to that moment when he thought that he was in a group that maybe didn't need a vaccine? We know from all the reporting, you can be 35 and healthy. This virus doesn't care. You know, when he first got it, he said, "I'll be back at work in a few days."
Right.
How did he realize, whoa, this is serious?
Well, he was very close to death at several points in here when his O2 levels dropped. But he's always been communicative when he is not sleeping, which they encourage him to do a lot to save his strength. What his regret, he said, you know, "I made the decision based on my situation, but I know now that a lot of people didn't get the vaccine because I didn't get the vaccine. And that is what I would like to correct." And that's my purpose for being here today, is to take the message that he's unable to take. And that is, take politics out of it. It's time for us to get together and fight this thing collectively, and just put all the conspiracies and microchips and all that business aside and go get vaccinated. And don't put your family through what his wife and the rest of us are going through.
As you well know, there's been anger at him from people saying that's too late. Not only did you get sick and put others, including nurses and doctors, in jeopardy, but people listen to you, your listeners listen to you. We know that community leaders there are telling people to back off. But do you understand some of that anger and frustration?
I do. And I also understand that it is reserved for people who, with whom they disagree with politically.
Look, let's concentrate on your brother.
Please.
He might still die.
He could.
And you know, my heart breaks for you, but tell us more about what he wants people to know.
Robin, I can't undo what's been done. All I can do is try to do as much as we can to fix it. Let me just tell you, we've had dozens and dozens and dozens of people who have responded and written in and said, I went and got the vaccine today or yesterday because of this.
Wow.
We had one
That's
man yesterday that was at a clinic, and he said there were 12 people in there, and five of them were because of what's happened to Phil. So that word is getting out. I'm doing what I'm doing to get that information out. The whys and wherefores and what happened is less important than people going ahead and getting the vaccination. That's, you know, what I'd like to see happen.
Well, in fact, did you?
I did. As soon as I found out that this thing had hit him like it hit him, I went directly to the Walmart and I said, you know, y'all pick the arm. The guy says, do you have any questions or concerns? I said, yeah, I got a bunch of them, but do it anyway.
And it sounds like what you're saying is, you know, we can disagree as Americans about the border, about all sorts of other things, but this one thing, you, Mark Valentine, and your family firmly believe that the vaccines help.
I
hope he's back on the microphone with his new message. Do you think, though, he'll be embraced by, I mean, we're hearing Tucker Carlson and Laura Ingraham still spreading terrible disinformation about the vaccines and about COVID. Do you think he'll be welcomed back into that kind of club, which is conservative radio?
Well, I can't speak to what Ingraham and Tucker are putting out. I hadn't had any conversation with them. All I can tell you is what Phil's going to do. And Phil will be the most pro-vaccine person you've ever seen as soon as he's able to be.
Well, we look forward to that moment. Mark Valentine talking for his brother, talk show host on Nashville, Supertalk 99.7, Phil Valentine, who's been hospitalized with serious COVID-19 after, you know, deciding not to take the vaccine. Phil and his brother, now advocates for the shots. Mark, we wish you and your family well. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Robin.
And we'll follow what we hope is Phil's recovery. He is not out of the woods by any stretch. We want to thank you for listening to his story and others on your local public radio station or website. You can tweet us feedback on this or any story at Here and Now, or you can find me at Here and Now Robin. Our co-host Tanya is at Tanya Mosley.
And I'm at Celeste Headley. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR. I'm Celeste Headley.
As it turns out, I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now.